That's not.
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Enjoying their wonderful evening wherever they are on our beautiful blue planet. I know most of y'all are familiar with our election results. I want to tell our president-elect, congratulations, Obama. I see he won last night. Other than that, I'm not going to discuss politics other than what Charles Hall and I discussed this evening. But I want to welcome Charles Hall. He's been a guest on the show. Well, he's been on Wake Up USA a couple of times with me, and he's been on UFO Undercover before. He's very interesting to talk to. He's got a lot of information. We will go over his book tonight for the people who are not aware of him or not haven't heard of him or read him before. And we will tell you every way you can get him. But, Charles, how have you been, man?
Oh, I've been fine. How about you?
I've been doing good. I've been looking forward to talking to you. Lately, I don't get to talk to people much because they keep me so busy. And I had told Linda, I said, you know, I have to talk to Charles. Well, I want to get him on a show so we can see what he's been up to and what kind of good stuff he's been doing, you know, because I enjoy the books. I enjoy the conversations. And your case, to me, is very unique because, you know, it's not a single case so much as that I've actually had a couple of people, and that's something else I wanted to talk to you about tonight. I've had a couple of people in Vegas in the last 2 years tell me things that may pertain to what we've talked about in the past. And I will get into that a little bit later in the show, but, you know, for me, because of the way you describe the case and the type of aliens we're going to be discussing, and being that it's a very unique thing to you, I've always found this very interesting because, you know, it's another species of alien visiting the planet. But anyway, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, and we'll start from there.
Sure. To begin with, I want to thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah.
I always enjoy being on your show. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and as you see on my website, I have a website. It's millennialhospitality.com. And pardon me for stuttering. I guess it's just the way I am. In July 1964, I enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, and I went and I did 13 weeks of basic training at Lackland. And we'll come back to how I got to be a weather observer. And I got to say, I eventually ended up in tech school and became a weather observer, and I ended up at Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, in March of 1965. I was an enlisted man at the time. I've since gotten a master's degree in nuclear physics and other education, and they sent me out to the Nellis Gunnery Ranges at Indian Springs, Nevada, which in those days was 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas. Vegas has grown, so today I guess it's like 40 miles or something out. And while I was out, I was stationed at Nellis for the next 2 years. I stayed there until May of 67, and then I went to Vietnam, and I was in the Delta with the South Vietnamese. And I came back from Vietnam a year later in May of 68, and I received an honorable discharge. Then I met my wife and got married and went to college at the California State University in San Diego, and while I was out on the gunnery ranges, I discovered that there was a base out there north of Indian Springs that the U.S. Air Force maintains with aliens and for the aliens, and I describe those days in my four-volume book, Millennial Hospital. I've written four books titled Millennial Hospitality. And and you see them described in my website. And what I try to do in those books, everything in those books is true. I had to be, because I work for the government and I'm a computer expert. I'm a government contractor. I had to be very conscious. I didn't want to upset anybody. So I had, or I'd lose my job and maybe get taken for a ride somewhere. And so in the first three books. I changed the names of all the people and the places, and I also changed some distances and directions so that I wouldn't upset the government, because my goal in writing the books was I originally started writing my memoirs for my children and grandchildren, and then my wife, when she found out about the books, insisted that we publish. And so the books can names, real places, and so on. And so book four in the series, I really do use the words Indian Springs and Nelson and so on. And everything in the book, including my Vietnam experiences, is true and happened to me. I started out, while I was out in the desert with the aliens, I got to observe their craft at close range. Now, they never came to teach me anything, but you know, being out there for 2 years, the first 6 months was very terrifying, because it took me 6 months to get over the terror of meeting them, even though they were friendly. And friendly meaning that if you didn't hurt them, they wouldn't hurt you. And after I got control of myself, or, you know, got, you know, kind of as described in book two, after that crucial night and described in the chapter, the journey, then I got to where I could sit down and, you know, watch what they were doing and think about it. And I came to the conclusion that there had to be more force fields in the world of physics than what Albert Einstein knew about. And I wrote that up into a theory I call Hall photon theory, and that's described in the appendix of books three and books four, and I've copyrighted several papers. And because I believe that there are physically more force fields than what Einstein knew about, and that those force fields are used when the aliens are designing their spacecraft, and so therefore, not only are all my experiences true, the physics is true as well. When you, my theory is that inside each photon of light, that there's a third field, and so on. And I'll be happy to go over more of that as well. You see that I have and my books have been very well received and widely acclaimed, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you would like me to answer.
But I just found out about the fourth one the other day.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, I did. I thought there was only three. And then a friend of mine, actually a mutual friend of ours, he said, no, Joey's got four. I'm like, no, when I talked to him, he had three.
I just published my wife and I just published the fourth one. And it includes a section called Credible Updates. Over the years, since I've published my first three books, I've met many people all over the world who've come to me with telling me things that happened to them. And I've captured some of them credible of those in Book 4. And Book 4 also includes additional episodes, things that happened to me when I was out in Indian Springs, and it also includes more of Hall photon theory.
You know, it's interesting because I've been bringing some people on the show in physics. You know, I've had a couple of physicists on the show, like Mitchie Cake, who's been on, got another one coming on in January.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I do that, to be honest with you, is because of stuff like we're discussing tonight. Other things that I discuss with other ufologists dealing in these fields, because, you know, it's important to you know, we tell people all the time, well, aliens are visiting a planet and so on and so forth, but it's nice occasionally to bring in and explain the physics of some of what we're talking. It helps the layman understand, you know, because they're listening to these Harvard scientists say, oh, well, you can't come to the planet. It's impossible.
Uh-huh.
So now we have other scientists and other physics, and some quite credible and some quite established, that are saying, oh, well, no, that's not true.
No.
We think it is possible to get to the planet in several forms.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just nice to have them come on. And I know physics is over a lot of people's heads, but I know a lot of people also can grasp the basics of understanding, you know, of how things work or how the universe works or how you may, you know, there was a gentleman I was talking to just recently about faster than light travel, and he said instead of trying to break Einstein's laws, why don't we cancel them out by using some kind of field technology?
Yeah.
Well, that seems like the right thing to me. And then I've heard you talk about it and a few others, but I'm going to get you to talk a little bit more about that. I just want you to kind of give them a basic layout of what we're talking about on fields here.
Sure. Now, on the physical fields, the physics of UFO space flight?
Yeah.
Well, the tall white deep spacecraft, they were large, they came in several sizes, and they had an outer titanium hull. The largest was about the same size, roughly, as a cruise, you know, like if a person goes on a cruise in the Caribbean, you know, on one of those cruise liners, well, the largest of the tall, white, deep spacecraft were about that, were roughly that size. And they were ellipsoidal. They were streamlined to travel at very high speeds in space. So when I say they were ellipsoidal, you know, egg-shaped, with somewhat flattened edges, those outer edges were extremely smooth, and then they were built with a double hull. So, and in between those two hulls were thousands of miles of fiber optic windings, and then you know how an electromagnet is built, where you have a battery, and then you take like a copper wire that's insulated, and you wind it around a, say like a nail, you know, like 100 times, and turn on the battery and magnify and amplify the magnetic field. Well, that's what the tall whites were doing with those optical fiber windings, but it wasn't the magnetic field or the electrical field that they were amplifying. It was, there were several additional force fields not yet known, not yet discovered by Einstein and what I call the physics of Einstein. There were at least three of them, three different force fields that I described in the appendix to books 4 and also in book 3. And for example, and then they had the deep spacecraft that they used to come from there, from wherever they had come from out in space, to here to the Earth and then to return. And then they had the scout craft using the same technology. The scout craft were white. And the scout craft were built entirely using parts provided to the tall whites by the U.S. Air Force. And the U.S. Air Force had simply gone around and gotten a whole bunch of off-the-shelf parts, like, you know, from travel trailers and so on. And then the tall whites had built, had assembled them in their in the main hangar of their base, there in the mountains that are physically north of Indian Springs. When you're actually on the highway at Indian Springs, Nevada, and you're looking straight north, then when you look straight north and a little bit to the east, that's Area 54. And when you look straight north and a little bit to the west, that's Area 53. That's the original Dreamland. The main hangar is in Area 54. Area 53, everything is underground. They live in tunnels, and that's their living area. And those two mountains are all honeycombed with tunnels and man-made caverns and everything. And that's where the and the scout craft also had a double hull. And the way you'd create the force fields is they would have these generators that would create various types of subatomic particles. I don't know which ones, but they were particles that were very easy to create, perhaps mesons. And then they would be accelerated. Then these particles would be sent down through the optical fibers, and the optical fibers were designed to bend the field, you know, to bend the path of these moving particles the same way that a copper wire bends the path of a moving electron. And remember, an optical fiber can be very complex. It can be, and they were ceramic optical fibers, not plastic, and they weren't necessarily hollow. Because a fiber optic, you know, can be like a piece of ceramic coated with elements like erbium, or they can be like coils wound around coils. And remember, and this technology, you know, by doing that, they would do it in these different sets of coils. This gave them the power to protect themselves from radiation, because there's huge radiation fields out in space. To defeat gravity, to rise up, to turn to the left, the right, and so on, to accelerate. None of their craft had any windows in the back, because that's where the power plants were. And also, it protected the occupants when the craft was totally powered up. It protected the occupants from the forces of acceleration and deceleration, from the inertial forces. Now those force fields, when powered up, extended quite a ways out from the craft. The fields coming off the scout craft, it wasn't unusual for them to extend as far as a mile and a half from the craft. the deep spacecraft, one night I was watching one of the deep spacecraft come in over Dogbone Lake, and I was at range 3, so we're talking about something that was 40 miles or so northeast of me. And normally those craft would come in like at 8 to 12,000 miles an hour and then stop suddenly in midair at about 10,000 feet. They would only touch down if they were in trouble or suffering some kind of mechanical difficulty or something. But on this night, the craft was coming in much faster, perhaps 20,000 miles an hour, because it appeared to be coming in much faster. It was coming so fast that it was really hard to judge its speed. And the pilot, it was coming in at sundown on the night of the full moon, because the pilot, as usual, was trailing the Earth in its orbit, like a plane trailing an aircraft carrier. And the pilot apparently had misjudged it, so when he was, as he was coming in, he was coming in faster than he wanted. So he apparently felt that he suddenly had to power up that craft to stop, to slow down, because he was coming in faster than he'd wanted to. And when he powered up that craft suddenly, it made the electrical light in my weather shack blink, and it drove the generator offline, because as you see in my books, I had a diesel-powered electrical generator out there. And that was at 45 miles. Now, there weren't any actual electrical effects. There weren't any sparks or any, blue aurora or anything. That means that field that he was powering up suddenly had to be able to interact with electricity and magnetism, but it was not itself an electrical field or a magnetic field. And since all those fields were being generated by subatomic particles, that means that the very basis of electricity and magnetism has to involve an additional field not recognized by Einstein and the physics. If physicists would just look at the standard experiments, the ones that everybody knows about, and just think about them, it would be so obvious that there's a third field involved. Anytime you talk about, like right now when we talk about radio waves, we say they're electromagnetic fields, because according to James Clerk Maxwell in 1864, that's two fields. But if you thought about it, if Maxwell had thought about it, he would have seen immediately there had to be three fields. Einstein should have seen it as well. When you talk about the Michelson-Morley experiment and you say it failed, Einstein didn't want us to recognize that it failed because there's a third field inside of each photon of light. And that's what's, and when it's going through the interferometer and stuff, that's the field that's controlling things. And it doesn't have anything whatever to do with relativity. Relativity is just a math game, where you say, I'm not sure what all the terms are, so I'll make something up. Relativity is little more than a mathematical parlor game. The place where Einstein went wrong was he couldn't tell the difference between this mathematical parlor game called relativity and reality. So Einstein would go around saying things that were patently ridiculous if you think about them. He kind of claimed that time slowed down for real when you were moving. That can't possibly be correct. If that were correct, then when you built if you went out to a particle, to a cyclotron or a subatomic particle generator, and you accelerated an electron to 99% the speed of light, then the electron would be in a different time frame than the particle, than the target you're going to jam it into. That means the electron would go right on through because it would be physically in different time references. But because a high-speed electron hits the target, that means that time is the same both for the moving electron and the target. That time is moving, that they're both in the same time frame reference, time frame reference. And there's also, when you go into the physics of it, it's so patently obvious that Einstein was confusing his mathematical parlor game that would let him predict a few useful things with reality itself. That's why Einstein's Grand Unified Field Theory attempt failed. He spent 20 years trying to figure out the formulas that would describe how energy in a gravitational field could be transferred into energy in an electromagnetic field. Well, he was certain that could happen because when you study distant galaxies and stars and stuff, it's obvious that gravity, that energy in a gravitational field can be transferred to an electromagnetic field. But his failure to unify those two, everybody said, oh, it was just so hard, maybe he didn't know math well enough. Really, it's because he didn't have all the parts of the puzzle. The energy in the gravity field doesn't translate directly to the electromagnetic field. It translates into at least one other field in between the gravity field and the electric field. And so you have to take into account what's happening in those in-between steps. You know, energy from the gravity field to the field I call the starshine field, and from the starshine field to the electric field. You know, there has to be more steps in there. So what Einstein was trying to do is the same thing you and I would be doing if we were trying to play the game solitaire with a deck of 49 cards. You know, we'd have to say, oh my golly, you know, we'd have to make up things for why there don't seem to be all the cards. Of course, one of the aspects of Hall photon theory is there have to be more quarks than what have been discovered. When you classify the subatomic particles according to the so-called eightfold way, the theory of irreducible groups, and you decide there are three quarks at work, that's true. But the point is that there's more particles than what you've classified. So that means the particles the particles actually have more quarks than just three quarks. It's just that if you pick a class of things like baryons, you know, created from a class of three quarks, the other quark, the fourth and the other quarks in that group are all the same, so you don't see them at work because that's how you classified them, you know. You have to take a broader picture and go looking for those extra quarks, and then you'll suddenly see that there's more that each particle has more quarks, and therefore, since each quark gives its own unique force field, there are more than four force fields at work, you see. I'll give you a real good example of the double hull construction. I got a chance to see some of the original files of Roswell, 1947. Roswell was real, but that was a little gray craft. I've never met a little gray, and I never want to.
Yeah.
But see the according to the actual major, you know, the one who is so famous for kneeling next to the wreckage of the weather balloon, he said in his report that what he had in the hangar was more than the bodies of the dead aliens that had been on board, and the one that lived long enough to make it to the hospital. He said he had more than the aluminum parts of the craft, and which he described as, in his words, looking like an explosion in an aluminum factory. He said half of that hangar was full of something he called angel hair, and you and I would call fiber optics. He said that when they got to the crash site, that the craft had sprung open like an electromagnet, and that those pieces, it had physically blown open. It hadn't just broken open and spilled. That all those, of course, the reason it blew open was because they were all full of subatomic, the power plant was still running. It still had the subatomic particles and all those fibers, and when it crashed, what followed was crash and burn explosion. And see, he said that you could find that the last half mile or so from where, when you were going to the craft, that those pieces of fiber optics lay so thick on the desert that you couldn't step anywhere without stepping on them, and that he and the men found pieces as far away as a mile and a half, and I saw one of those pieces in the summer of 1956 in London, Wisconsin. Arnold Palmer, that great UFO guy, he was the classmate to the guy that ran the grocery store in my little town of London, Wisconsin, and they were good friends from grade school. And he showed one day, Arnold Palmer, the guy who started flying saucers, and the guy running the grocery store and me was when I was like in the sixth grade. We were in that grocery store, and he was showing me a piece of that fiber optics. And it clearly bent the light from his flashlight without allowing any light to escape from the side. And he said that the two federal agents came and, you know, and very politely explained to him that they were leaving with that piece of angel hair, one way or the other. And I still remember him getting out of his car. Because I was there, I'd been down at the grocery store, before he arrived. And he was telling me about some of the things that he had found when he went to Roswell, and that was in 56. That was several years after, because as you know, Roswell was 47.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about the people he had talked with. And one of the things the government had been especially brutal about was not ever mentioning the so-called angel hair, the fiber optics. I also note that Alan J. If you take a piece of fiber optics, which is ceramic, and you heat it to a temperature and melt it, you'll see that it's 49.5% aluminum, and that it melts at something like, and I'm doing this temperature from memory, but they typically melt somewhere like around 1,100 degrees or something. Don't quote me on the temperature, but I just want to mention a number just for to make the following point, that if you melt fiber optics, what you have looks like slag from an aluminum furnace. And I note that Alan J. Hynek, in his book, published more or less about 1968, he said that he had like 500 or 600 samples of stuff that had melted and fallen off from what he believed to be credible flying saucer reports. And he said he had had them analyzed, and every time they would come back 49.5% aluminum, and then silicon and other metals, and that people would discount the trace amounts that would come back in those reports. The trace amounts are the really important ones, because the trace amounts are what's coming back from the coating around those things. That's what you want to know. Did they coat them with erbium? Did they coat them with, what are the other elements they were using to coat the fiber optics with? In his book, he didn't appreciate what he had. See, just like Roswell, once you realize that half of the hangar was full of fiber optics, you say, my golly, that's got to be the power plant, you see? Because who else would put that much work into a flying saucer or any kind of spacecraft if it doesn't have anything to do with the power, the propulsion, the safety?
Well, yeah. I could see having fiber optics run through the craft, but not that much. I mean,
see, Alan J. Hynek, if you got 500 samples, well, gee, by the time you get to the third sample, you say, wait a minute, there's got to be something going on here. The only way you could have that many samples from all different kinds of spacecraft is for there to be an underlying physics that's using that technology. See, because you're talking about alien species that don't like each other, or talk to each other, like the tall whites and the little grays. They're natural enemies. And when you say, well, wait a minute, the tall whites are running that same technology the little grays are, that means there's got to be an underlying physics to it. And if they're using fiber optics that we made for them, which they were, that means that if the Air Force were bright enough, it'd build its own, see? Yeah,
which they probably have in those TR-3Bs, or black triangles, whatever you want to call them.
Well, no.
I don't know if that's exactly what that is, but it's. I'll tell you one thing. Let me do a quick station ID.
Sure.
Everyone, you're listening to UFO Undercover on 105.3 New Orleans. I hope everyone's enjoying the show, too. Also, remember, if you happen to be out and about, driving around, and you want to listen to us, and you can't get us, and you don't have an Internet connection, you can always call us. You can always pick up your cell phone, dial up SNAP at 704-631-4060. Put the station ID code in, 2899, and bam, guys, you can listen to us anywhere in the world now, anywhere, via your cell phone. Just flip it open and tune in. Plug it into your car, plug it into your radio, do whatever you want, but you can listen to us anywhere now. So no need not to hear us. You don't have to wait to catch the podcast, which are always available within 5 minutes of the show, but you can catch it that way. Again, that's 704-631-4060, station code 2899. Also, remember, you are listening to us on 105.3 New Orleans. And one final note to a good friend of mine and a host of a show called Voice of the People. Happy early birthday. I know tomorrow's your birthday, but I might not get to see you. So I know you're, getting up there in the 70s now, so be careful. Anyway, November, enjoy your birthday tomorrow. Okay, Charles, I just had to get that out right quick.
Oh, I understand. Totally. Bye. see, when you look at existing books where they say, gee, they went back and studied Roswell, one of the things you'll notice is that nobody ever mentions the fiber optics. Mm-hmm. And you know, and when you say, well, gee, is the government covering up something? My answer is, well, you know, when in the case of the Roswell incident, you couldn't possibly go out to that crash site without first being stunned by all the fiber optics, you see? You know, before you ever got to where, see, you know, everybody says, oh, gee, the aluminum covering or the metal covering where you would bend the foil and it would return to current shape, that meant nothing. That's not the propulsion system. That's simply the weather covering over the fiber optic windings underneath it, you see? Their craft had an inner structure to it, and then fiber optics around that, and then they'd covered the coils with that, with a metal that didn't have to be, you know, tied into place, but just knew its shape, to protect the outer, you know, to be a weather covering for the windings. I hope I didn't lose you.
No, I'm fine. I'm listening, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, it's been dead out, and I was listening. So.
Yeah, you know, my wife always says that someday I'll die and I'll be talking 2 days later, you know.
Actually, though, you know, I tell your wife again, because I'm glad she got you to publish the book, because, you know, I've met other people who write books, but they won't ever publish them, you know.
Well, see, thank you, you're so kind. See, Alan J. Hynek, like many UFO investigators, after assembling the parts, didn't know how to connect the pieces. And so what he did was, there was a time when he went around and he wanted people, you know, who might have gotten a glimpse of the inside of a saucer or gotten a peek through a window or an open door. He used to say, well, did you see an aluminum furnace, you know? And so he had all these guys running around trying to locate aluminum furnaces on board flying saucers and trying to figure out, you know, what function would an aluminum furnace, you know, be performing. Well, of course, there's no aluminum furnace on a flying saucer because, you know, that slag is from the coil.
Yep.
The reason the coils are running hot and melting down is because they're running subatomic particles, which are radioactive.
Well, I would imagine that fiber optic winding has to be replaced every so often or replenished. They might actually have a feed system for it that it's replenished every so often.
And see the tall whites, they were very conscious of the temperature of those coils. In 1965 and 66, I used to watch the tall whites, using their scout craft, take American generals to the moon and back. Now, I never went along because, you know, I was just an enlisted man. But the way they would do it is a day or so after the moon was in the fourth quarter. Now, when the moon is in the fourth quarter, it's in front of the Earth as the Earth travels in its orbit. And the moon in its orbit is physically traveling in the part of the orbit that will go in between the Earth and the Sun. And since the tall white craft were powered by pushing and pulling against the gravity fields, they were very conscious of the structure of those invisible gravity fields as they exist out in space in the vicinity of the Earth. That meant that just after dawn, and at dawn, you're on the part of the Earth that is leading the Earth in its orbit. So in the fourth quarter, you're on the front of the Earth, you're looking straight up, and you see the moon, you know, above you, and there's a clean, solid gravity field from where you are on the front of the Earth to a place in space just in front of the moon. And that means that the way you take your high-powered, gravity-powered spacecraft to the moon and back is so simple, any kid can handle the controls. And groups of tall whites, like four or five, along with groups of American generals, typically two or three, would take the scout craft. There were several models. They would take what I call they came in different sizes and they were characterized by different numbers of seats. They would typically take the one that had seats for 10 people. It also had a galley and a bathroom and RV type things, as I describe in my books. And what they would do is they would, just before dawn, they would bring it out of the scout craft hangar at the north end of Indian Springs Valley and bring it down to the west side of the valley and sit down before the sun came up, and then during the early stages of the dawn, and then the aliens and the American generals would get off the craft, and the generals would stand clear of the craft, intentionally standing with their back to the craft, because the aliens did not wish to share the propulsion technology with humans. And then the aliens would open up the doors on the scout craft that over these windings, especially in the back half, and make sure they were all properly cool, you see. And this would typically take, and then they'd typically be sitting down there for like a half hour. And I'm out there at range 3 with my theodolite and taking, you know, and finishing up on the 4:30 a.m. Weather report. And then after the sun had come up, i.e., after you're on the part of the Earth that's on the front of the Earth, just on the sunlit side, then they would close down the things, prepare the craft for travel. Everybody would get back on board. There were no seat belts because the craft didn't require them. You know, you'd close the door and then you'd totally power up. And when the craft powered up, the way the craft would look as it sat there in the desert, it was about 3.5 miles away from me at the time, is it would appear to fuzz over. So when it wasn't powered up, it would look the way you'd expect, like the hull of an aircraft or, you know, the hull of an RV. But once it powered up, then all it would look like is like a fuzzy white egg sitting out there. And then they would take off and they would head for a place in front of the moon, you know, in between the moon and the sun, but in front of the moon, they would be following that gravity highway, and then bypassing, driving past the moon, and it would only take them 15, 20 minutes to make it from here to the moon, because it's only 240,000 miles, and the scout craft, the technology would permit it to travel faster than the speed of light, although it wasn't made very well, so they didn't usually go anywhere near that fast. They usually only went to like 10% or whatever. But either way, you know, you could make it from here to the moon in 10 minutes, no problem, whatever. Well, then when you got in the vicinity of the lunar orbit, then remember you weren't aiming straight at the moon. You were aiming at the empty space in front of the moon. Then they would power back until the gravity of the moon, because they were heading for that place where the gravity of the moon, the gravity of the Earth, and the gravity of the sun are all equal. And when the craft got that far, they would power back and let the gravity of the moon take over and pull them around the far side of the moon, which, after all, would be lit by the sun at that time, or at half of which would be lit by the sun. And then they could loiter there in the vicinity of the moon from about 6:30 in the morning Earth time till about 11 or 11:30 in the morning. So it'd be 4 or 5 hours in the vicinity of the moon. Then they would come back to the Earth using the very same technique, where when you were at the moon, if you looked up, you'd see just behind the Earth there's another gravity highway, and then they would come back, and then if they overshot the mark, they would just go into one orbit around the Earth. But the place where they took off from, Indian Springs Valley, is now coming up on noon, which means it's coming up on the side of the Earth directly facing the sun. And so they're landing in sunlight. And then they would come back to that very same valley where they took off from, that very same place in the valley where they took off from, and sit down with the craft, and they would open up the craft. The American generals would get off laughing like they had just come off the roller coasters at Disneyland. They would come off, bend over, laughing their frickin' guts out, and then they would stand clear of the scout craft and stand with their back to it. And then the tall whites would go and open up the things over those coils and make sure they were cooled down. And then they would wait a half hour, sometimes 45 minutes, until the coils were nice and cool. Then they would close it all up, and they would get back on. Then they would get back on the craft, and this time they wouldn't power up completely. They would just power up part way, and kind of loiter their way back up to the main hangar at the north end of the valley. One of the reasons they typically waited a half hour to 45 minutes was it would take the American generals that long to stop laughing and where they could get back and sit down and go for another ride. And I used to watch them do that on a monthly schedule back in '65 and '66. those UFO reports that say that when American astronauts were walking on the moon, that there was a white UFO object watching them from just over the horizon are totally credible. It's just what nobody expects is that what's on board those white UFOs isn't just aliens, that there's two or three American generals on board as well, you see? They're watching the American astronauts from just over the horizon on the moon.
Yeah, guys, say, we're going to send our astronauts and we're going to fly up and watch them. That's pretty good, though, you know.
Yeah.
Get a bird's eye view, go up there, check them out. Oh, I forgot to mention something at the break. Y'all, you know, we have there's a new truckers reporting site out there now. If you're a trucker and you're on the road a lot and you're traveling, it's www.tuforc.com, guys. This is for the truckers out there who are cruising around. I mean, if you're policeman, fireman, whatever, you can report there, too. But a good friend of ours had set this site up, and they've been taking reports. And we're just trying to give everywhere, you know, another place to put information out there. So remember, www.tuforc.com. Okay, guys? All right, sorry, Charles. Got to get all these plugs in these days. In the old days, we didn't have to do all of this. Now we got to get plugs in for this one. Oh, something else. And I almost forgot. Steven's going to kill me. Ladies and gentlemen, million letters. Come on, guys. Barack Obama is going to be the president. He's the president-elect. He's not president yet, but he will be January 20th on the inaugural day. Everyone, write their letter, okay? Now, I know you've heard Stephen Bissett on my show and on several other shows on this network and several other shows about that, the million faxes to Washington. Get your pens out, write your letter, send it in. And when you do, send me a letter, let me know you wrote it. Send a letter to Stephen Bissett, let you know it. But get out there and write them, okay? Whether or not we're going to get disclosure from Barack, I'm very skeptical about, okay? But Stephen's a good friend of the network and a good friend of ICAR and a good friend of ours, and if we can help him in any way in this campaign, we want to. So I know there's a lot of listeners to this radio show.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear 5, 10, 15,000 of y'all write in. I know tonight we're going to have 1.5 million listeners. So, guys, pick up your pens. You know, if you want to send an email, you can. If you want to make a phone call, you can. But we would prefer if you did it snail mail, okay? Write a letter, send it in to the president-elect, Barack Obama. And you should be easy to find now. Tell him we want disclosure. Disclosure, okay? Enough about all of that now. Yeah, I knew I was forgetting something, man. Yeah, I forgot because I had Stephen on a couple of weeks ago, and we had talked about this, and I promised him that the day after the election, because I knew I had a show coming up, that I would remind everyone to get out there and write Barack Obama a letter. Write him a letter. He's going to think half the country's lost its mind when we start writing in about UFOs, but hey.
Remember, ever since Reagan, at least, the new president, I have no idea what they'll do with Obama, but the new president, it's been common for the so-called guards, the Secret Service who guard the president, to put on a party for him sometime in between Christmas and New Year's. And it's been common for, in that party, for a human to dress up to look like a tall white and to crash the party. and remember, the first person I'm certain they did that with was Reagan.
Yeah.
And then that is supposed to be the guards' way of preparing the guards, the people who guard the president, as well as the president, for what it's like to be around a tall white alien. Because even though they're friendly, they're not human. Their movements, their reactions, and so on are different than what a human would be, or can be different than what a human would be. It takes the new arrivals a while to figure out, you know, to teach themselves or to get used to being around humans. And, of course, every man I ever knew that when they first came across a tall white found it just mind-numbing, myself included. And you had to get used to actually dealing with them in person. And so the first, that party is usually the guards providing the president and the new guards of the president an opportunity to get used to reacting when a human is behaving like a tall white. Now, then later there's a second party where there actually is a tall white, because the tall whites, they're not, I mean, they've been here for so long, they know our form of government, they know exactly, like when I was an enlisted man in Indian Springs, they knew that I was just a schmucko, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If they had any doubts, they could just ask an American Air Force general, you know, what's Charlie Hall's rank, and the general would have me doing push-ups, and he'd demonstrate who's giving the orders and who's taking them. And see, from their point of view, they're very proud of their ability, their independence, their ability to handle themselves, to negotiate for themselves, and so on. And so, see, from the tall white ambassador insists on talking to the American president directly, just like all the other ambassadors. See, and see, in my books, the teacher, she had been, the CIA guard that I talked to, he had described that famous scene when she almost fell in the White House on the Capitol steps, and he had, that I have mentioned from time to time, and he'd reached out to steady her by grabbing onto her elbow, and she, took out that instrument of hers and made him feel like he was hanging on to 100,000 volts AC, and when she finished with him, it was nothing but yes ma'am, no ma'am, And see, that was because the tall whites insist on actually meeting specific Americans, the president, the secretary of defense, and so on, face to face, just like the ambassadors of the other nations do, you see? And so that means that Barack Obama doesn't have to, when you send him letters that say, we want full disclosure, maybe the first time he gets the letter, he'll say, boy, these guys, I'm not sure what they're thinking. But I guarantee that in short order, pretty soon he'll be filling in those blanks with some direct face-to-face discussion with somebody, because the tall whites, they're very proud of their independence and their intelligence, and see, their electronics allow them to tell what you're thinking, and they therefore insist that when they talk like to the American president, they come with their electronics on to see exactly what the president is actually thinking. See, there's, whereas if they were, that's why they insist on face-to-face contact with certain humans, like the president, the secretary of defense, and so on. You see, it's so that they can, the electronics which they bring with them, which they wear in their head, which typically, is concealed with a hat or a wig or a helmet, That allows them to tell what the human is thinking, and therefore, whether or not they're being told the truth or lied to or whatever, whether or not they dare trust them. See, of course, they don't really trust humans, but they do that for their own self-defense.
Yeah.
Okay? And as you see in my books, you can communicate with, when they're wearing the electronics, you can communicate with them just by thinking. And if they're not wearing their electronics, then they either have to speak English or you have to go back to hand signals. And they insist on doing that with the generals, the president, the important leaders of the Senate and the House and so on, as their way of dealing directly with the American government.
Well, one of the CIA guys, one of the Secret Service guys I met a few years ago, informed me, and he still insists to this, by the way, that no first-term president is ever informed about the extraterrestrials. And now, I imagine if they're requested, they might be, but he was saying in general they won't inform a first-term president because they don't know if they're going to stay. And they're scared, like people like Carter just let them have the information because they don't know if they'll stay quiet when they get like Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton's one of the presidents make you nervous, but we don't know for sure.
That might be true. Remember that the tall whites, throughout most of their adult life, they're the same height as you and I are, or as I am. I'm 5'11", and see, the teacher could dress up to look like a nurse, and if you were the president and you were like in a briefing where the lights were turned down, you might not be aware of who else was in the room.
Sure.
And so, because the government's a big place, and see, whereas they might not tell the president the lady you're talking to is an alien, Or they might not tell the president, well, really, we've met four or five of them, and four or five different kinds, and, you know, some you can meet with, some you can't. While they might not, while they may or may not tell him that, they have to tell him that the tall whites insist on actually coming up to within a short distance, because their electronics is subject to interference because it's microwaves, and they insist on coming up within a short distance. It could be as far away as a quarter mile, but they insist on coming up within, and it might be as close as 20 feet, and just to tell what that person is thinking, you see.
Yeah.
And even though, so the president might not be told that the person they're dealing with is an alien.
Which makes sense to me.
You see, they might not be told that that person is an alien, but in the first term, the president has to be told about the existence of UFOs and aliens and so on, or else he might accidentally order a nuclear attack. You know, like he might mistake an alien spacecraft for, like, something the Russians are doing, or the Chinese, or the, you know, and so on, you see. And I'm certain, you'll notice in my books that there are two kinds of aliens that I've personally met face-to-face. One is the tall whites, and one is the ones that I call the Norwegians with 24 teeth. It's the Norwegians with 24 teeth are, if you didn't know better, you'd think they were just from southern Norway. You know, so I feel quite certain that the president would at least be introduced to some of the Norwegians with 24 teeth, because of the building project going on in the Aleutian Islands, and also the building project going on east of Prague, which I feel are both related to communicating with the star that the Norwegians come from, which I think is either Bernard's star or the next star out at 6.5 light. Bernard's star is 5.5 light years, and the next star out is like 6.5 light years. They're coming here from one of those, and so I wouldn't, you know, question what the CIA guy was saying. It, you know, it makes perfect sense. But it's just that remember that. The aliens like the teacher and Range 4 Harry, who are used to being around humans, if you didn't know better, they could walk right up to you in a casino, and you wouldn't know that you were talking to an alien if you didn't suspect.
That's pretty much what he was saying. And then he said on top of it, if for some reason there was a need to, or if something arose where they had to tell the president, they would, but he was telling me it was more for plausible deniability, and that and the fact that they did not consider some presidents to be trustworthy.
And
it is need to know, and they said a president doesn't need to know unless there is something pressing at the time that they have to know. So I know Reagan knew beyond any reasonable doubt. I know Bush Sr. knew. What bothers me is, since Reagan, it seems like only the Republicans knew. I'm not sure about Clinton, because the Clintons really had a hardcore interest in this, but they kept it throughout their whole 8 years, so I'm not sure they ever got the answers they were looking for.
The letter that I saw for the Roswell incident, mm-hmm. written by that major, the one who's pictured, and this has nothing to do with my current assignment, it's just that I've been following UFOs for, you know, since I was a kid. But many, many years ago, the letter that, in a different time, a different place, the letter that I saw wasn't just addressed to Harry Truman and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was addressed to two senators and two members of the Speaker of the House and two other members of the House. It was addressed to a senior corps of guys, that where the guy clearly said, "They're aliens. I got the body, and the hangar is half full of angel hair, and the other half looks like an explosion in an aluminum factory." And goes on to describe how the incident happened, and how the Roswell incident happened for real, and that was 1947, so that was told to a group of people who were believed to be trustworthy. Now, I agree with what the CIA guy said, that that it wouldn't be unusual for there to be people who weren't deemed trustworthy, and that would be by for example, the Tall Whites themselves. They were very touchy about whether or not you were telling them the truth. One night in 1965, when I was out at Range 3, I was out there by myself. And one of the alien generals came walking down the bunker road. He was one of the older ones, and consequently he was taller than average, but he was still in good health. He didn't require someone else to go with him and study him the way some of the really old, or most of the really old Tall Whites required. And that sucker would have put Patton to shame, you know, in terms of disciplinarian, and, you know, when he gives you an order, you hop to. And he had his electronics turned on, you know, real nice and high. And when I was out at the, he came out and he was wearing his suit, and he took up a position on the balcony of the control tower at the north side of the Range 3 area. And as I brought my weather balloon out with the light on, he started using those electronics of his. He started communicating with me. Because he could, he had his electronics adjusted correctly, and he could tell everything I was thinking. I was scared out of my frickin' gourd, and I thought I'd gone nuts, to be truthful. And he was asking me, what are you going to do? And, the way a general would, I'm an enlisted man, so when I say the way a four-star general would ask of me, I mean it was no back talk. And after I had released the balloon and tracked it and stuff, and I was gonna take my clipboard with my numbers back to the weather shack and do the computation, he'd asked me what I was gonna do, and I told him I was gonna do that, and I'd only taken a couple of steps away from my theodolite, so I was like out of arm's reach, and I remembered that I had forgotten my clipboard, because I was scared as hell, and you forget things when you're afraid. And I stopped, and I turned, and I was just going to take like those two or three steps back to the theodolite to get my clipboard, and that SOB called me on it right there. Why are you doing that? You said you were going to go back to the weather shack, and I damn near had to beg for my life just to take those two or three steps back to pick up my clipboard. And so if the Tall Whites thought that you had told them something intentionally not true, you were in for it. And so when you say, well, gee, you might not tell the president that they were here, a first-term president, that you didn't trust that they were here, you're also protecting the president, because once you tell him that they're here, if he starts making statements to the Tall Whites that aren't true, their reaction is way different than what a human's is.
Yeah.
You're probably
making them real nervous.
Yeah, I had to practically beg. I was down to saying, well, gee, I'm human, and I was afraid of you, and I was down just inches from begging for my life. If I had said something cavalier like, well, you're an alien, I can lie to you, my golly, that sucker would have turned me into powder,
Yep.
We'd have discovered right there who was giving the orders and who was taking them,
yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, it would have been me taking them,
you can't really blame her. But anyway, we're going to have to take a break, so I'm going to put you on hold right there, because we've got to take about an 8 or 9 minute break. Also, the star you were talking about after Bernard's star is Wolf 359 at 7.7 light years.
Sounds familiar.
And, from Star Trek, if you're a Star Trek fan, y'all should all know Wolf 359. So if you're not, well, then you don't know what I'm talking about. But
I'm
it is
a
real
Trek
star,
fan,
by the way.
I was more into Spock,
But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Joe Mantel, the host of the show tonight. Charles Hall's with us. We're discussing Millennium Hospitality, the four books that I'm sorry I couldn't get that out for some reason. But when we get back, we're going to get a little bit more into that. Some other stuff that's happened to Charles, maybe some stuff that some people told me out of Vegas that Charles might be interested in. But until then, ladies and gentlemen, I want everyone to please stay tuned to UFO Undercover. We'll see y'all in about 8 minutes. So see y'all later. And
UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Welcome back, everyone, to UFO Undercover. I hope everybody's enjoying the show this evening. Sorry about that little overblast there. I wasn't paying attention, but I hope everybody's having a good night. I always enjoy having Charles on. We've been talking about quite a few things tonight. We're going to talk about some other stuff, and there's some stuff I'm going to bring up to Charles's attention that was recently brought up to mine. He had done a show with me, I think it was a year and a half ago. It's been a while. I think it's been about a year. And on the show, I had asked if anybody out in Vegas had maybe had some experiences with these tall whites. And I'm going to get Charles to explain to you why we're bringing up the Vegas connection in just a minute. But I have to tell you, Charles, I had four or five people write in to me. I talked to three of these people on the telephone. They gave me some pretty in-depth stuff. Couldn't tell you, 100% how much of it is true or not. But it did, for lack of a better way of saying this, authenticate a lot of what you were saying as far as the particular visit to Vegas, which I found interesting. So I'm going to get you to tell the audience a little bit about what I'm talking about the Vegas thing.
Yeah.
So let me get you to just tell them, well, how can I say this? I'll let you go ahead and explain it. Go ahead.
Well, see, the tall whites, as I describe in my books, are men, women, and children, and they're so much like us that the biggest shock is that they're so much like us. They don't handle anger the way we do, but they love their kids, and they live longer than we do, and they love one another, and of course, they get bored just like we do. The most common reason for the women to bring their kids, for the tall whites to come around, was that the women had small children who found it fun to play where I was releasing my pretty colored balloons. And therefore, see, with a city like Las Vegas so close, it was very common for them to want to go into Las Vegas for entertainment for the same reasons that we humans go there, to see the lights, the glamour, and so on. One of their favorite places was the old Stardust. It used to have a cheesy motif when you'd go in. They'd have aluminum foil stars and galaxies hanging from the ceiling, and so it was like when you were gambling, you were out among the stars, and the tall whites used to find that really hilarious because they have a very dry sense of humor, because they had just gotten here from being out in space, and that's what we thought being out in space would be like. And the CIA used to run, for the old Stardust, used to run this concept of the safe casino. They had the CIA had a team of guards, a pit boss, and some blackjack dealers and the dice table croupiers and so on. And then who weren't told any details, they were just told that these people were your friends. And of course, it was common for the tall whites to come in. They'd never come alone. They'd typically come in with their guards, surrounded by other CIA guards. So that section of the strip would be, would be fairly safe. And if they came in at a time like 3 a.m. on Sunday, between Sunday night and Monday morning at 3 a.m. in that time frame, mm-hmm. those casinos would be running pretty empty. And so, and of course, at that time of the morning, nobody looked human anyway, even the youth. And so you used to see them come in at that time. They would always dress up and disguise themselves to look like humans. The teacher's favorite disguise was that of a nurse. Her skin, the tall whites, their skin is naturally as white as a piece of paper. And so for the teacher to dress up and look like a nurse was very easy. It only required a little bit of makeup. Because of course in Las Vegas you have so many show people and dancers and so on, and the tall white men and only the young people could do it. The people who were still about my height, if they got very old, the older ones who had gotten taller, couldn't disguise themselves that way. So they wouldn't come into town. But because when they got really old, they might be 8 or 8.5 feet tall. But as long as they were, not higher than 7 feet, and, some basketball players, many basketball players are 7 feet high, they could blend into the crowd. The men would typically put on black suits and sunglasses to conceal their eyes, and also and put on some makeup. And, of course, although the suits look black to us, the tall whites have eyesight as good as that of a cat and hearing as good as that of a dog. And so if you could actually look at the suit and their guards who would come dressed in black the same way, if you were actually able to look at their suit the way, and see somewhat into the ultraviolet or somewhat into the infrared, there really were markings and insignias and stuff like that on the suit. It's just that to a human, they all look black. You'd have to have, like, ultraviolet light or something to actually bring out those markings. So they could always tell who they were in the crowd, you know. And at night, of course, that was, there were always lights around because, Las Vegas, Glitter Gulch. And then what they would do in Las Vegas is entertain themselves. They loved to come in and just, to walk around and to when I say socialize, I mean they didn't socialize with humans, but to socialize between themselves. The same way that, like, when my wife and I and my daughter, say, went to Spain, the three of us, my wife and I and my daughter, liked to go into, like, the English court department stores in Marbella, Spain. We loved doing that and shopping, you see, and just looking around. And although we didn't socialize much with the local Spanish people because our Spanish isn't that good, but it was really entertaining, and that's what the tall whites are like, and they do it for the same reason. One night I remember seeing some of the tall white mothers with their children playing in one of the parks in Las Vegas on the swing set and so on, while other tall white mothers had gone to some stores on the other side of the park and were shopping for clothes. And so, the tall white women, if you were talking with the tall white women, one of the most common topics, the most common, was how they loved their children and how their family was doing and so on. But another real common topic was clothes and fashions. They didn't come to teach me anything or to talk about the future of the earth or environmental warming or anything, What they came for was the same thing that mothers and housewives and stuff all over the earth, human mothers and housewives, care very much about. How well their child is growing and what's the price of some pretty new dresses and so on. When I would see new arrivals get off from time to time, it wouldn't be unusual for them to be very proudly sporting a shirt, always cotton or nylon, because the tall whites are plant eaters and won't have anything to do with wool or animal clothing. They always wanted something that was like nylon or cotton or something of that nature. But you know how when we go on a trip, we might naturally buy a few clothes from a faraway place and be very happy and proud of it, and they were the same way. And so for them, there was a lot to do in Las Vegas. And, of course, after you sat out in the desert at Indian Springs, and I speak from direct experience, I was a young man. After 5 days, a man needs a little action, into those casinos. Just, if nothing else, just to go to the bathroom at a different job.
Yeah.
And as I describe in the opening chapter of Book 4, it wasn't just the casinos they liked to come in. In 1965, you could come in off the desert on the northeast side of Nellis. You could come straight down the valleys from Indian Springs, where their hangar was, and you could, without ever crossing anything but miles and miles of barren open desert, which the scout craft could cross, just in minutes. You could come into the north side of Nellis, and you could park that scout craft out on Sunrise Mountain and come in off the desert without ever so much as crossing a barbed wire fence, which was no obstacle whatever to them, with the suits that they wore. And you could come straight onto the hangars at Nellis where the airplanes are parked and see on Saturday night after everybody goes home, that whole northeastern section of Nellis, there was only one person on duty at 1 a.m. in that whole northeastern section. That was the weatherman at the Nellis weather station. And and when you went down on the flight line down in the aircraft hangars, those doors would be standing open in the summertime, and inside would be American airplanes and American and tools and stuff like that. And new arrivals just getting off their spacecraft, many of the men, the tall white men, found that to be interesting for the same reason that when we go into a museum, say like in Europe, we find like the armor that and the swords and stuff that people used to use back in the time of Columbus or the time of the Romans, that we find all that to be of, you know, of interest. And that's what the tall whites used to find interesting, the same way that we would find a museum or an art gallery or something interesting. Well, of course, when you do that, there's no bathrooms down there, especially for the women. There's only one. There was in 1965. There was only one decent set of bathrooms for men and women on that whole northeastern side, Nellis, and that was the weather station where that one weather observer, his name might be Charlie Hall, would be working. You see, and that was down in the base operations section of the weather station and base operations shared the same building. And base operations was the Nellis equivalent of the aircraft terminal, where you had bathrooms and where, you know, when planes landed with people on board. And so it was no surprise. So you see in book four, my very first duty station, the guy relieved told me that the place was haunted because, you know, he'd come across them going to the bathroom. Well, the ladies needed to go to the bathroom for the same reason that human ladies like to go to the bathroom, or, you know, like to go to a good, clean, decent bathroom, you know. They don't want to, you know, have to, you know, respond to nature's urges way out in the sagebrush, and so on. And so, you know, once you got on to how they thought, then coming across them and meeting them or encountering them or whatever was pretty common, you know. Once you understood that they were real, that they were human, that they liked to tell jokes just like we do, that they loved each other, they got bored, they just happened to be very good at building airplanes and suits that protected them. And they weren't the slightest bit afraid of us because they had an agreement with the government. See, they came with their guards. They always came with their guards. They always came armed. If they went into Vegas, they would come with human guards as well. And if they ever got in trouble, they only needed to make one immediate phone call to the Pentagon. The Pentagon calls the governor of New Mexico, of Nevada. Nevada calls the state police, or the Pentagon calls the state police directly. And they got friends, and then the CIA has already made provision for safe casinos and safe places for them to fall back on. If you were in one of those places like Caesar's Palace, which was a place that they really enjoyed, because of the grandioseness and stuff, the statues and everything, if you even suspected that one of them might be an alien, you would never actually be able to get right up next to them and confront them, because all they would do is their electronics allowed them to communicate with each other electronically.
Yeah.
And if one of them felt that you were getting too close, she only needed to call for her guards, or he only needed to call for his guards, and then the electronics they wore allowed them to put the ideas directly in the minds of the human guards too. And what you'd find is a couple of human guards coming, a couple of casino bouncers coming and explaining that you had had too much to drink and you were
time for you to leave.
See, so they felt totally safe doing that, wandering. But the new arrivals are naturally more afraid of us than we are of them. The new arrivals, there were new arrivals out there that wouldn't approach me closer than 3/4 of a mile in the desert. They had to learn to overcome their fears, but once they'd been here a while and they had learned to be around humans and had overcome their fears, well, you know, and gotten used to the system, you know, it wouldn't be at all unusual to see them right in Las Vegas. They had, as I described in book three, they had that black car that was handmade, and they undoubtedly had more such cars, but they had that black car that they didn't have to even bring the scout craft into Las Vegas. They could just bring the black car straight in off the Nellis Ranges onto the freeway and just drive into town the same way that everybody else did, and park the car out in back of one of those casinos like Caesar's Palace, and if you weren't, remember in 1965, the Las Vegas Strip Once you could physically go out the back door of the old Stardust and be entered into miles of desert. It wasn't like now where the strip where Vegas is wide. So it was the simplest thing in the world for them to just come in off the desert into those casinos and wander through and have fun and go back out into the desert.
Yeah, Vegas has definitely grown. There's no doubt about that one. Oh,
yeah.
Lord. You know, I got a couple of questions came in, and one of them was somebody wanted to know, hold on, let me scroll up a little bit here. Besides the tall white, what other ETs have you seen or have had contact with?
The Norwegians with 24 teeth.
Okay.
I'm certain that there are other.
Yeah, there's a...
I'm certain that there are little grays, because the Roswell craft was a little gray craft.
Yeah.
But I've only personally met the Norwegians and the tall whites, and I have no desire whatever to ever see the little grays.
Well, that's some of the other ones you definitely, if you can avoid meeting them, you'd probably be better. Now, before I get this other question up here, I was thinking when we had you on last time, I had a cab driver call me in, and he was in his late 60s, and he had told me about seeing some stuff down there. It was two cab drivers, and one of them had called me and told me about some stuff he had seen down there in the mid 60s and early 70s, and it sounded a lot like what you were talking about. He said, but what was funny about it was he's the dispatcher for the cab company down there in Vegas now. He said, I want to introduce you to these two guys that have recently seen something down there in Vegas. And then they proceeded to describe almost identically to what you have described. Now, at the time, now maybe they heard you talking. You know, I can't rule out that they may have heard you somewhere before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, both of them swear they had never heard of you, and they didn't know anything about this other than that they had heard me talking about it on the show, and that they felt the need to call in because it sounded identical to what they had seen and experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just odd. You know, it's always odd when people call me and write to me or tell me things like this.
That's really interesting.
And what was even more interesting about that is about 3 weeks later, I get a phone call from a retired state policeman down there. I say his first name is John. I got his last name, too. But he said that he could verify that at least on a dozen occasions, he knew the tall whites had been in several different casinos. And I asked him if he would be willing to come on the show, and he declined to come on the show, but he didn't decline to talk to me about it and give me information, and he also didn't decline on me checking on his actual police record to find out if he was a state trooper, and if he was a state trooper for, I think, almost 35 years, retired in outstanding standing with the Nevada State Police, and guess where his beat was? Las Vegas. So I just found it odd that he wrote in and he told me this stuff, and he told me the very first time he had found out about this was in 1967. He was on patrol when he got a call from the Secret Service and asked him. He got a call from his commander to meet the Secret Service at a particular casino where they were going to cordon off a whole entire casino for some special, they said, out-of-country visitors. And
mission from northern Spain. They loved that cover.
Yeah. And he said when he seen these people, he said, they kind of looked like people, but he said the whole entire time, he said, I kept having this feeling that, one, he was being watched all the time, and then he said a couple times he felt like somebody was in his head. And then he just said, he said, after a while, he said, me and my two partners were talking about it. He said, they thought they were some kind of weird hybrid or something that maybe the government was working on. And then he had, seen them on a couple of occasions. And then when he had heard us talking on the show that night, that's what got him to actually call in. And, he got us in touch with the other guys, or the other guys got us in touch with him. But because of that one show we did, I ended up talking to these four different people. And I found it just weird.
You see that electronics that they use to where they can tell what you're thinking and they can put their thoughts in your mind, presuming that you're relaxed and calm. If you didn't realize that they had that electronics, you'd think you were going nuts or that you were maybe kidding yourself or something, But see, you can tell. See, I know it sounds stupid, but when they're doing it, if you're aware that they can do that, you can tell the difference between your thoughts and the ones they're placing there. And see, once you get the idea, they actually prefer to communicate with you by just, you know, you thinking the thought like, now I'm going to walk towards the door, and them asking you a question like, you know, what direction are you going to walk next? Do you see them? And you'd say, I'm going to walk to the door. You'd think that. And once you get the idea, it happens, at least in my case, at about half the speed that a person would normally communicate if you're talking with words. But see, when you first come across it, it's such a shock because, you know, like I would be out in the desert, like in 65, before I realized what they were there and what was going on, I would be out in the desert at night for the 4:30 a.m. run. And I remember one of the first nights, I was certain that I was being watched from the darkness between some of the sagebrush plants. There was no moon, and it seemed hard for me to even think, control my own thought. Yeah. And really, it's because there actually was one of the tall white guards.
They were actually watching you and influencing you.
And using that technique to see if I was angry or trustworthy or if they were in danger or to make sure I didn't come out to where they were, or so on.
Now, Phil writes in from Vegas, no less. Hey, Phil in Vegas, since we were just talking about Vegas a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to know now, he's asking, basically, was this an accident that you happened to get put in this particular base, or do you think they purposely picked your personality to go out there and put you in this position to meet these aliens?
As I describe in Book 4, the Pentagon wanted me there. And as I describe in Book 4, when I went in July of 1964, when I enlisted in the Air Force, I was sent for basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. And then they give you all these tests, you know, to see what you're good at.
Yeah.
And I got a perfect score in logical reasoning, convergent-divergent reasoning. I outthought the great explorer Cadillac, who previously had been considered to have done the most perfect job. The Cadillac was the guy that discovered the Great Lakes. Anyway, so then I was supposed to stay there and until I got my top secret clearance, and there were two other guys with me, and so they cut my real orders for RIA school, where you study Spy School 101, and at San Angeles, Texas, and being a weather observer at Chinook Air Force Base, Illinois. And if my clearance came through, then it'd send me to San Angeles. And my clearance came through. But my orders were so highly classified by the government, by the Pentagon, that they were kept in a special locked safe. And the day they came through was a Friday, and they came through for the other two guys, too, who were getting sent for high jobs at San Angeles. Well, one of the other guys with us, who was in PATS standings waiting for his orders, was mine in the store, the squadron day room. And he knew about the orders for the other two guys, and so he gave the other two guys their proper orders. But for me, mine were more highly classified, and he didn't know they even existed, so he gave me the cover orders to Chanute. So, you know, I had my orders, so I got on the next plane the Saturday night to Chanute Air Force Base, and I ended up in weather school. Well, after I'd been there like a couple of months, I wasn't getting paid because nobody knew I was on base. They all thought I was, you know. And so, you know, so I went down to the payroll and asked why I wasn't getting paid. And they were shocked that I was on base. And then the next day, and said, we'll get back to you. And the next day, I was in class, and two guards and a dog came in and escorted me to the Chinook Air Force Base Commander's office. And they had me stand there, and the base commander said, Airman Hall, if you have a set of orders showing that you're supposed to be in this base, then you're a happy man, and the captain who gave them to you, I understand, might be looking at 5 years in Leavenworth. On the other hand, if you don't have a set of orders, then he's a happy man, and you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
And then he proceeded to say that you are too valuable a person to be wasted as a weather observer. And, you know, he'd gotten his orders from the Pentagon, and I had two copies of my orders. I was right there, you know, making sure he could read every word. So then they sent me back to weather to finish my weather class. I was always on the top of my class, and I was always getting my three-day passes and everything. And so then when it came time to fill out the paperwork and say, where do you want to get sent, I put down England and Germany and March Air Force Base and Los Angeles, and the sergeant came and said, no, they're telling me you're going to Nellis. That's where the Pentagon wants you. And then they shipped me to Nellis, And then that picks up at the beginning of book four, where the Pentagon wanted me for the first, my first duty assignment, to serve with that weather observer before me that I described in the opening chapter of book four. And picks up with those other statements in book four, the one where the major called me in and said, you know, do you have friends down in the Pentagon? And I said, no, nobody in my family's ever done the service. And he informed me that I had friends down in the Pentagon and so on. And so the Pentagon wanted me out there in the desert from the very earliest times. Yeah.
Well, that, yeah, see, that's why I was asking, I should say Phil was asking, but I was curious myself. Now, hold on, let's see how much time we got left. Yeah, we still got a few minutes here. Let's see, I didn't want to run us over too far here.
Uh-huh.
Let's scroll down the list. That's a dumb question. Uh-huh. Oh, okay, here, this is a pretty good one. This is Sandy. She's writing in from Southern California.
Uh-huh.
Basically, what she wants to know is the fear factor, like the first time you met him. Now, we've talked about it, so, and I know you were scared.
Uh-huh.
Now, what she's saying is she's heard you say that there was some fear with the aliens also associated. In the first meeting, she wants to know, who was scared, are you or them, or was it an equal thing?
The new arrivals, the tall whites who got here on Earth and have never seen a human before, are more terrified of us than we are of them. But the very first times I came across them, I was so terrified. There were nights I would have run away, but I was too afraid to move my feet. And it took me, as I described in book four and in book one and book two, it took me almost 6 months to get over that fear. And the reason I finally got over that fear was because I got sick of being afraid. I just decided that I was going to be the person I wanted to be, even if it killed me, you know, just for a day. And because being around them, even though they're friendly, in 65, you know, when UFOs are swamp gas and anybody that's an alien is nuts, that terror is just beyond description. On the other hand, for them, it was the same way. And for the new arrivals. Now the base, though, had many people like Range 4 Harry and the teacher who had been here. They live longer than we do. They typically live 600 to 700 years, and those people had been here for like 200 years, and they were used to being around humans, you see. So for those, when they first met me, they weren't afraid because they were so used to being around humans, they understood what humans are like, you see. So, see, and Range 4 Harry had a very dry sense of humor. The 41 weather observers that I know of that had been sent out there before me, you know, Harry had that dry sense of humor where, you know, if you asked him, like one weather observer was asked him who he was, and he said, I'm Range 4 Harry. I'm the big hairy monster from Range 4. And, of course, he found that to be really funny because he was really quite frail and didn't have any hair on him except for a little hair in his head, you know, because they have way less hair than a human does. And he found that really funny. And the guy and the weather observers, he was running away in terror. He said Harry was standing back there laughing, you know, like, you know, boy, I scared you, didn't I? You see, when you say how afraid were they when they met me, it depends entirely on which one you're talking about. That alien general wasn't the slightest bit afraid of me and was, you know, perfectly willing to just walk right up to me and cut me down like a dog if I look cross-eyed, you know. So it made all the difference. On the other hand, that some of the children might have fainted if I walked up to them, you know. And so it made all, each one of them is a separate individual, and so it made... So you had to say exactly which one you were talking about. You know?
Now, I have Crystal writing in from... Oh, wait, sorry. Long one. We're going to skip that. Sorry, Crystal. But we'll see if we got time to get to your question. Actually, Denise is writing in from New York City, and she had heard us talking on a previous show about interaction with children.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to know how you felt about it and how the children felt about you, I guess.
The children loved to play hide-and-go-seek, and they loved to come and play where I was and to watch the pretty balloons. They're just like human children. The children's eyes work the same way ours do. They don't broaden their vision, you know, into the ultraviolet and into the infrared until they get somewhat older. And so, like, if I was painting by color, they loved to come and watch me paint by color and stuff. And see, they loved to go riding in a car, and the adults loved to go riding in a car too. So, like that cab, those cab drivers in Las Vegas, when you say, "Well, why might he have had cab, tall whites in his cab?" It's the same reason that we ride roller coasters in Disneyland, because for them, they had scout craft and they had the black car, but see, new arrivals and the guys who had been here, they thought that was really fun to go riding in a car, and to see how humans did it. And some of the children, like the little fat astronaut, or the one that I dubbed the little fat astronaut, he used to like to sit in my truck and pretend he was me and put his hat up, my hat on his head backwards and pretend he was driving me. And the first time I saw him doing that, I thought it was nuts. I was standing there saying, so this is what insanity is like. And gee, it's so painless, you know. I don't feel any pain anywhere. And so you see, from the point of view of the children, you know, each one of them had a personality as well. The one that I call in my book the tall, thin Einstein, or the young Einstein, that one night he was explaining to his mother that he had measured every possible measurement on my theodolite stand, and he was telling her what the measurements were in English units, and he was so proud, and the mother was so proud. It was almost like a science fair project where you'd say, if you picked some ancient system of measure, like say the units that the ancient Chaldeans might have used, and went out and started measuring like your desk in school or something in those units, and say, gee, you know, I weigh 4 stones and the thing is 2 rods tall and so on. And he was, and so each one of the kids had their own personality as well. And well, the adults, some of them like to come and watch, like the medical doctor that I describe in book 4 in The Wayward Wind. He loved, what he cared about was human emotions and stuff, and so he liked to come and watch that. He didn't have the slightest interest in, like, the mechanical aspects of how you fill a balloon or the artwork in my garage or whatever. On the other hand, others, like those electrical engineers, they came and they wanted to see how I started the diesel and got electricity. They didn't have the slightest interest in, you know, human emotion or, you know, whether or not I was afraid or any of that stuff, you know. So each one of them had a separate, unique personality, and you could see it immediately in their children.
Yeah, well, I can imagine the children were just fascinated. But you know, it's like anything else. One, it's just like an American being overseas or anything else. You want to meet, you want to see how other cultures live, how they act, how they react to you. Why do we consider some things fun and other people don't? I can understand all of that. I was going to get Crystal's question in, but I know we're just about out of time. So why don't you give them a list of the website. Mention all 4 books again, and we'll give them which...
The website is www.millennialhospitality.com, spelled like it sounds, MillennialHospitality. Google it, okay? It's millennialhospitality.com. And the 4 books, there's 4 books. You can buy them off my website, or you can buy them through Amazon.com, or you can buy them from Author House, and or order through any bookstore in the world. And the 4 books, the first one is Millennial Hospitality, the second one is the Millennial Hospitality 2, The World We Knew, the third one is Millennial Hospitality 3, The Road Home, Millennial Hospitality 4, After Hours. You can read them in any order, because although it's common for people to read the first book first and the second book second and so on, what I tried to do in each one of the books is to capture how I felt each day that I was living it. And so they're very emotional books. They're suitable for children. I took all the profanity out. I know in the military you swear a lot. And I wrote them in. I'm not trying to prove the aliens are real or make any kind of statement about government cover up or whatever. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to answer the question: how did it feel the first time I came across them? And you know, how, being terrified, how did that feel? And to convey that to the reader. And you know, like in book one, the day I was down at Range One. And I saved the life of the little girl who was the daughter of the teacher, the tall white lady whose CIA name was the teacher, and then by rescuing her from the sagebrush, and then when I realized that she wasn't human, And, you know, the terror started setting in. Writing the books was very difficult because I had to relive I had to relive all those events, and the emotions, the ups and downs, the good times, the bad times. Then I had to remember and I had to relive all sorts of things, like the night I was on the road down to Range 1 coming through the mesquite before the dry lake bed, and they were in the tall whites were in on both sides of the road, and there's no place to stop or turn around, and you're heading away from base, and you don't even know what's out there, and you're alone, and you know there's no help coming. It's that you're inside a restricted area that's inside a restricted area that's inside another restricted area, and the Pentagon, the generals have made it very clear that there's no help coming. You know it. The aliens know it. You took yourself out there alone. Those were your orders. You get back or you die trying. And so they're very emotional books, and I tried to pass that emotion on to the reader, as well as the happy times or the humorous times when the teacher would come, like in 66, and make fun of the American generals who had no fashion sense, and so
They don't either. Generals have no fashion sense.
Yeah, so they're the kind of books that you might read just for the fun of it, or the children might read, school children might read for the fun of it. Or adults might read for the fun of it. It doesn't criticize the military. You could send it to, your friends in Iraq or anywhere, because they're not. You don't have to agree the aliens are real to enjoy the books, because they're. I tried to capture, how it felt to live those days.
Well, I know, Charles, I want to tell you thanks again for being on tonight, because you're always a fantastic guest. And by the way, I was talking with a gentleman about you a couple of weeks back, and somebody had asked me, he said, what was Charles doing trying to prove the existence? I said, no. I said, Charles is trying to share his experience.
Yeah.
I said, whether you believe him or not, I don't think it's that important to him. I said, he's really just sharing his experience. I said, because he's not out there like all the other ufologists trying to make a point. It's simply you're saying, here it is, take it for how you want to take it. Which is the way you should do it. I mean, you take it how you want to take it. If they believe you, fine. If they don't believe you, fine. That's their business. But again, I want to tell you thanks for being on. You're always a fantastic guest, and I'll look forward to talking to you in the near future. Hopefully I'll see you out and about in ufology land. Also, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't remember the site and you would like to visit his site or get one of his books, it will be posted on UFO Undercover, so you can find it over there. Eventually, a lot of the affiliate guests will be posted on the IACAR site as well. One of these days, I'll get around to putting all the associates up there and friends of IACAR and Paranormal Radio. But these days, they keep me real busy. Again, Charles, one more time, I want to thank you for being on tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to UFO Undercover. I hope y'all had a great evening this evening. I hope you have a great evening, and I hope people do me one favor. Smile, enjoy life, have some fun.
And thank you so much for having me.
Remember,
it took me 6 months to finally accept the fact that the aliens were real. So, I understand if you read the books and say, gee, I'm not sure they're real. Because the first 6 months when I lived it, I said, gee, I'm not sure what I'm looking at is real, even though they're opening the door to my weather shack.
Thanks again, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for tuning in.
From one place to another, my golly, that can't be real,
Yep, that's true.